I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, work, and study, the Awabakal and Worimi peoples. I extend that acknowledgement to the land on which our listeners meet. I pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. Thank you to our sponsors, Espresso Warriors Katara and Dark Stories Newcastle, a true crime tour company where you can experience live and interactive crime theatre. Use the code DARKCCJS25 for a special discount. In today's episode, I'll be talking with Dr. Hayley Cullen, PhD and Associate Lecturer at the University of Newcastle, about false confessions. Before we get into it, I'd just like to amend a statistic Hayley and I cited in the podcast stating 27% of DNA exonerations in the USA involved a false confession. This was actually supposed to be 29%. Regardless, I hope you all enjoy the episode. Hayley, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
I started looking into false confessions maybe 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to say I know probably exactly the same amount as I did when I started. So it's perfect. It's really good that you're here.
Got a lot to fill you in on, okay?
Need the help.
All right, cool. Well, where can I help?
Well, why don't we start super basic. What is a false confession?
Okay, that's a good question. So false confession is kind of as it suggests, it's when a criminal setting, it's when people falsely confess to crimes that they didn't commit or that they weren't involved in. You can have false confessions for other things. So, you know, in an academic setting, if a student cheated on an exam or said they cheated on an exam, that would be a false confession if they didn't do it. But, so you know what I'm saying. So I'm basically just saying that you can have false confessions in non-legal contexts. You could falsely confess to stealing something you didn't steal from, you know, your friend's backpack, whatever. But in a legal setting, it's typically when you're confessing to a crime that you didn't commit.
I'm still caught up on the confessing in an educational setting. I'm scared. Would I ever do that?
You don't really seek a lot of confessions in other contexts. But I mean, let's say that you have a friend who, and this is maybe getting into kind of the reasons why people falsely confess, but let's say you have a friend that did something bad. They didn't want to own up to it for whatever reason. Maybe their parents were going to yell at them, whatever. You could take the blame.
Yeah. Okay.
So you see it happens in other contexts as well. But
how often does it happen? I mean, I doubt there's any way that we could really know like the true statistics of it, but how often do people suspect it happens in a legal context?
Yeah. So, I mean, if we look at wrongful convictions, in Australia, we don't have a great understanding of the prevalence of wrongful convictions. In America, if we look to some of the data, so the Innocence Project that you might be familiar with, they have a whole database of DNA-based exonerations. So when DNA is proven that someone couldn't have committed a crime, there's about close to 400 of these DNA exonerations, and the number's going up every day. But the DNA exoneration cases are really great because when we know someone is innocent, factually, we can look at what the contributing factors to that wrongful conviction were. And so based on those DNA exoneration cases, wrongful convictions that have a false confession, there's about 1 in 4. The numbers oscillates here and there, but it's around 27%.
So they don't have the DNA evidence, but they do have the confession?
So a lot of these historical cases of wrongful conviction in America, a lot of them are not recent cases. Some are from, you know, the 80s, 90s. I mean, some are more recent, but they didn't have the means of testing the DNA. So it was able to be collected, but maybe the technology wasn't advanced enough to test the DNA, or in some cases, the DNA evidence was withheld, legally or illegally. So in these DNA exoneration cases, the DNA's later been able to be tested, and it's proven that the person couldn't have committed the crime. In those cases, around a quarter of those cases involve a false confession.
That's so many.
Yeah. And it's a lot when you consider the fact that we typically think people don't falsely confess. I mean, why would you?
Yeah, like, right? No one can, like, personally say, I'd eventually confess to that.
Yeah.
You know, even if I didn't do it, I'd definitely do that.
Well, that's the thing, is that a lot of the time when you tell people that you study false confessions, they think, why is that a field? People don't, surely they don't falsely confess to crimes they didn't commit. But when you actually start to understand the psychology behind, you know, what happens in an interview with a police officer, the impacts of pressure and coercion, you can actually start to get a sense that this is something that is very much possible and does actually happen at alarming numbers.
Just because I'm flipping false confession and coerced confession in my head, are they somewhat similar, or is there
difference?
Is there different types of confessions in this regard?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's the literature's shown that there's three different types of false confession. I'll start with the kind of most basic one, which is a voluntary false confession. This is when people, without any pressure or coercion, they'll come forward and confess to something they didn't do. There's many different reasons for that, which I can get into, but you know, you might want the notoriety associated with a really high profile crime. So there've been cases in America where hundreds of people have tried to confess. I'm trying to think of the exact names of the cases. I think there was one where a child was abducted, where there was lots of people that wanted the notoriety of being the perpetrator of the crime. So that's one reason for a voluntary false confession.
Sort of like attention.
And the fame, I suppose.
Yeah.
Even though it's not something we typically want to be associated with, but...
Yeah, it would have to be quite... You'd have to love attention or fame pretty a lot to go to jail for it.
Yeah, and so that's not a super common motivation for a voluntary false confession. I'd say the most common is when you're trying to protect someone.
Right.
So if a family member's... You think a family member's committed a crime, you're going to maybe falsely confess in order to protect that person from jail time or whatever the implication of the crime is. So that seems to be one of the most common reasons why people will give a voluntary false confession.
I also read that there was sort of self-punishment, like consciously or unconsciously, they feel guilty to the extent for something else, and they confess to a crime because of that.
Yeah, so that's another motivation for a voluntary false confession could be that you want to relieve the guilt that's associated with something else you've done, whether it's a crime or it could be something completely different, right?
Yeah.
So it's just, some people might feel that they need to be punished for something that's happened, and this is a nice way to receive that punishment, I suppose.
I can't even imagine the psychological processes that would go into someone's guilt. I can imagine someone's guilt being exceptional, but the need to relieve that guilt by means of confessing to another crime is, like, it's obviously just something huge to unpack, at some point, but, like...
And, I mean, the science behind false confessions is huge. Like, there's, maybe not hundreds of people looking at this, but there's... at least dozens of people around the world that look at false confessions. So it's, because it is common, I didn't say this earlier, but the Australian statistics, we don't have a great repository here for wrongful convictions because we don't have a lot of information. We don't have DNA exoneration cases for the most part. So...
don't have many people living here.
We have a smaller population, but I suppose when you look at the cases that we know of, so Rachel Diozzo-Villa from Griffith University had put together a repository of known cases of wrongful conviction through the media, and it was about, in 17% of those cases, there was a false confession.
That's so much!
Yeah, so even though in Australia it's not as high as America, like, it's still a significant problem here, so... absolutely.
Is that for criminal, is that specifically for criminal cases?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And so we also see, so just going back to your question before about the different types of false confession. So you've got voluntary false confessions, that's the first type. And those are typically characterized by the fact that there's no coercion on the person to confess. They just come forward and do it.
Just out of nowhere.
Yeah. So for whatever motivation they have. But the person who's interviewing them doesn't put pressure on them to give a confession. The second type of false confession is what the literature refers to as a coerced compliant false confession. And so, like you said before, the compliant confession, it's a form of false confession, but it comes about because the person wants to escape the situation. So they're either trying to escape a very high pressure coercive situation, they might be trying to receive a reward that they've been promised, or they're trying to avoid a punishment that has been, that they perceive has been imposed on them. And that all comes about through the coercion that takes place in the interview or the interrogation.
What sort of practices... Let's not go into that yet. What's the other one?
I want to know so bad.
Let's save it. We'll keep it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose that the final type of false confession is a coerced internalized false confession. And that type of confession typically starts as a coerced compliant. I should say a coerced compliant false confession, when people give these false confessions, they still know that they didn't do it. So they have that awareness of, I didn't do this, but I'm confessing in order to escape this horrible situation or to receive some reward that I've been promised. With a coerced internalized false confession, typically what happens, yeah, they've got big names, but I mean, I suppose you can consider them compliant or internalized.
Yeah.
The internalized type of false confession, typically the person initially knows that they didn't commit the crime, but over time they start to believe they actually did it. And so they internalize that confession as being genuine and true. So it's almost like they've developed a false memory for committing the crime. And that's quite scary to think that just through the coercion of an interview, someone could come out the other side and think that they genuinely did something horrible.
You've done a lot of research on false memories and that, haven't you?
I've done a lot of eyewitness. So I suppose, you know, the eyewitness field, there's a lot of talk about false memories with victims of crimes. And to a smaller extent, there's the misinformation effect, which is when witnesses might, if they're exposed to incorrect information about a crime, they might accept that misinformation in the reports they give later. So I've looked at it in that respect, not as much in a false confession context, but it's the same principles that memory are, that are applying here, that a lot of the time what happens in these interviews is that the person is repeatedly told by an investigator that they've done it. You know, the investigator often believes that they're the person who committed the crime. So they're repeatedly being fed this false information that can then become embedded into what they think is true. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It's just scary.
Yeah,
yeah.
It is.
It's like,
it
it's frightening
is.
To think, like, you wouldn't think that you'd be in that position, or to think that you would ever, you know, begin to believe that you had committed a crime that you never had, or like, you know, frightening. I'm fine.
just to add to that level of fright, I think what I'll say is that, you know, we all assume that we would be exempt from this, that if we were in these kind of situations, that we'd be fine, we would never confess. But the more you start to find out about false confessions, the more you realize, like, anybody is vulnerable. Under specific circumstances, anybody could falsely confess when you start to understand why people do.
What are some of the risk factors that predispose people to false confessions?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, there's some general risk factors, and there's also some that depend on the type of false confession. So, I mean, people that are most at risk, juveniles, are a much greater risk of falsely confessing. So the reason for that is, I mean, there's a few different reasons. I suppose juveniles have less knowledge about the way the legal system works, so they're not as aware of the implications of giving an incriminating statement like a confession. They are, in some cases, more likely to waive their rights to silence, so they're more likely to speak. They may not have an adult present with them when they give information, or they might waive their right to have an adult present that can protect them from saying something incriminating. And one of the other things is that juveniles, typically they're very reward driven, and they're not as sensitive to waiting for things. So they're less able to delay their gratification, because what happens in a lot of these interview settings is they're very uncomfortable, they're very stressful, and juveniles just want to get out of there as quick as they can. So they'll be more likely to say something incriminating there and then, rather than holding off and waiting until later to get relief.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a concern. So juveniles are at risk. Individuals with cognitive impairment or intellectual disability are at risk for, you know, probably quite obvious reasons in not being able to understand the situation or the implications of what's happening. Other risk factors are things like sleep deprivation, which comes into some of the problems with police practices around how they can keep people for long periods of time without breaks, without rest. So sleep deprivation is definitely a risk factor. Another risk factor that I think is really interesting is innocence is a risk factor. And what I mean by that is that people who are innocent will typically, they don't want to stay silent. They want to clear the air. They want it to be known that they didn't do it. So they're more likely to speak. They're more likely to waive their rights to silence because they just want to clear it up right now. Like, I didn't do this. I want you to know that I didn't do it. And so the more you believe in your innocence, the more likely you are to speak in a situation where you probably shouldn't.
Yeah, and there's probably like a level of trust you have in the police that coupled with, you know, I'm innocent, these are the police who I trust. Like, I Absolutely. Can say whatever I want and they're going to get to the bottom of it. There's no way, I'm innocent, therefore how could they turn in any of what I'm saying against me?
Absolutely, and I think generally people do trust the police and you wouldn't expect that you'll be in a situation where you're being pressured to say something that you didn't do. It's absolutely a problem in that people generally think that the system is fair and just, and look, for the most part it is. I shouldn't say that the system is not just. I should also say at this point, I'm speaking a lot about an American context because the way in which interviews are handled is different in Australia compared to the United States.
And, surely the research is like heavily focused in the United States as well.
Yeah, exactly. So most of the research we refer to is from a United States context. The statistics, you know, the Innocence Project statistics on the frequency of wrongful convictions that have false confessions, that's American data. So it's, lot of this is I'm not saying it's not a problem here, but particularly when it comes to coercive interviewing, that's heavily an American problem. And it continues to be a problem.
Yeah, I'm sure there's like differences in like the legal practices associated with police tactics and investigation, but the psychology behind coerced confessions would be similar, if not the same.
Absolutely. Yeah, the psychology is the same. And I mean, even though Australia has a slightly different history, there are still known cases of false confessions in Australia where coercion has been used or there have been, you know, improper police procedures.
Hmm.
So it's not unheard of, but it's far more of a problem around coercion in America.
What are some of these coercive practices that the police implement? Are they intentional or can it occur more sort of subconsciously? Is that sort of like...
Yeah. This is the big question you wanted me to unpack at some point.
Here we go.
So, I suppose the first thing I'll say about this is that there's different countries have different frameworks that they use when they're interviewing suspects of crimes. The American system has and continues to be one that basically calls the interview an interrogation. So I'm sure people have heard that word of like, this person's being interrogated by police. The interrogation framework is very guilt presumptive. So officers go in to the interrogation thinking their suspect is guilty, which already creates a real pattern of behavior or a, you know, your beliefs shape the way you interact with people. So if you think they're guilty, you're going to interact.
They're moving with confirmation bias.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's a whole heap of confirmation bias. But the other thing that is problematic about the interrogative approach is that it assumes that suspects are going to be uncooperative, they're not going to want to talk, and that you essentially have to force them to talk. And so the dominant model of interviewing, or interrogation, I should say, that we've seen in America for the last 40 or so years is what's known as the Reed technique, which maybe some people have heard about. But the Reed technique, it was developed in the 1970s within the behavioral sciences unit of the FBI. Police are trained in how to use this technique. So it's not as if police are just going rogue. This is part of what police are trained to do. And the Reed technique essentially makes a lot of assumptions about human behavior that are completely unfounded and there is no scientific evidence for. One thing that police officers start with before they engage in like the proper interrogation is they do kind of like a mini interview with the suspect and they try to work out if the suspect is lying so that they know whether they need to subject them to a full interrogation. The problem with that is, as humans, we're not good lie detectors. There's no good technique for determining whether someone's lying or telling the truth. So this model assumes that police can do that when they can't. There's no evidence to say that police are any better than the ordinary human at detecting lies. And the ordinary human is really about no better than a coin flip anyway. So they're no better than chance at determining whether someone's lying. So that's a problem.
Love to hear it.
just a little bit of a problem from the get-go. And then I suppose what happens after this, it's called the behavioral analysis interview. That's that mini interview at the start. Then police in America that are trained under the Reid technique will subject the suspect to kind of 9-step interrogation. I won't go into all the steps, but some of the problematic ones
are... I've got time.
I mean, it'll be long and
are you
tedious.
Saying that you can't rattle them off the top yet?
What
you're saying?
I could.
You just don't want to.
Well, I mean, I suppose some of them are a bit more problematic than the others.
Yeah.
I mean, look, in a whole, the whole point of the Reid technique is police set out to get a confession. That's the end goal. So already, because they're assuming guilt, they're assuming that all they have to do is implement these techniques or tactics and get to the point of getting the person to sign a confession.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if they go after every single possible suspect with the intent of getting a confession, then there's a problem.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. And so one thing that police can do in America in a number of different jurisdictions is that they can present false evidence. So they could show doctored photographs, or they could pretend that there are witnesses that saw this person who don't exist. They can present fake evidence.
I thought that was TV.
No, that is genuinely part of the Reid technique. So that's a problem in itself, that they're able to put suspects in a situation where they feel like they can't get out of it. Because if you've got police officers that are saying, look, there's 5 witnesses that said they saw you there committing this crime, how can you get out of that?
Oh, with or without your confession, you're going to jail.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. They also use emotional manipulation. So they use good cop, bad cop techniques. Of, you might have one particular police officer who is being very sympathetic and is saying things like, you know, I know it wasn't your fault that you committed this crime, but if you tell us what happened now, that we'll let you go home and nothing bad will happen. Which is a lie.
Yeah.
But it's basically to minimize the severity of the crime, make the person think like a confession is their best option. You can also have the kind of bad cop technique where you increase the perceived severity of the crime. So you might say, you're going to go down if you don't tell us what you did. Your family is going to pay for this. You're going to rot in jail for the rest of your life. And that's scaring someone into thinking they should confess.
Yeah.
So you kind of got these two angles where you can be sympathetic and make someone think that they'll get something good out of confessing, or you can make someone think that if they don't confess, something really bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so, that's completely fine under the Reid technique as well.
And this is current?
Yes. So the Reid technique is still being used, despite multiple scholars, academics, lawyers, policymakers, all stating that this is a huge problem.
Is it not a legislative change to be made, or is it a practice change?
I think it's... I mean, I can't speak too much to the American system, but
yeah.
I'd say that it's... The problem with false confessions is also slightly more pervasive than that. So I suppose, you know, there's problems with the way that interviews might be conducted, but then there's also problems with how confession evidence is taken into court. There's problems with how, you know, just to give an example of, there's some research that shows that if an expert witness knows that the suspect has confessed, that can bias the evaluation they make. Let's say they're a fingerprint examiner. If they know that the person who's suspected of the crime has confessed, they're more likely to say 2 fingerprints were a match than not a match. So knowing someone's confessed can bias all these other decisions in the legal system. So I don't think the problems are purely reserved to what happens in the police station. That might cause a lot of the initial problems, but those problems flow on to other aspects of the legal system.
Yeah, I suppose they increase the likelihood of a false conviction.
Yeah,
like, yeah,
absolutely.
Or a wrong conviction, wrongful conviction.
And I mean, when you think about false confessions, like, they're so persuasive because, like we said at the start, you don't typically think people are going to falsely confess to things they didn't do. So if someone does give a confession, decision makers like jurors or judges in some cases, I mean jurors more so, jurors find that so compelling.
Mm.
Like, even if the confession was elicited under, you know, a lot of coercion, jurors find it very hard to ignore a confession. even if there's reason to believe it was false. So,
because most people typically just wouldn't believe that they'd give a false confession under any circumstances.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the problem, is that people...
You can even imagine yourself like being a juror and just sort of like being swayed quite substantially by
False confession. Like, imagine if you were a juror on a case where someone allegedly, or there might have been an oral or a written statement that someone signed that said, "I did this." What more evidence would you look for?
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, I think we need to now start to get to a position where we start to look at how confessions are elicited, so that we can get a sense of, was this confession voluntary? Was there any coercion when the confession was elicited? So we can get a sense of how true the confession is actually likely to be. Because many confessions that people give are true confessions. But there are, as we know from the Innocence Project and the data on wrongful convictions, we know that there are a lot of confessions that do occur that are false.
Do you think the DNA evidence these days maybe is weighted more highly than a false confession? For example, the 27% that you mentioned confessed when future DNA evidence came to exonerate those people. I assume that's how it happened. At least it was brought to light. Do you think that perhaps false confessions are now mediated or moderated? It's one of those, by DNA evidence.
So I think that would be a logical thing to assume. There's actually, surprisingly, I mean, I've been always interested in looking at what kind of types of evidence are given most weight by jurors. You know, are they more persuaded by confessions compared to DNA, compared to eyewitness testimony, for example? There's not a whole lot of research that compares across a lot of different forms of evidence, and usually then this research doesn't compare confession evidence to other types of evidence. So it's hard to know. I would suspect, I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to another great one, which I'll plug. It's an American podcast, and you know, thank
hang
you
on, I'm gonna sense this out. Yeah.
Wrongful Conviction. It's a United States podcast where they talk with exonerates. So every episode, there's a new person who's been wrongfully convicted that appears, and they talk through their case. And some of the false confession cases, I mean, a lot of them, like I said, they were juveniles when they were arrested and convicted. But it's actually startling to think of how little evidence was, the only thing that was pinning this person was the confession. Sometimes the confessions don't even match the crime scene facts or the facts of the crime, because when people give a false confession and they're pressured to provide additional information about what happened, if you didn't commit the crime, you don't know how it happened. So you might...
There's very little chance you nail all the crime scene evidence.
But I suppose that's also the problem with being fed false information and being fed information by police, is that starts... For some types of confession, police might give a hint of, well, this is what happened at the crime scene, or this is what happened, and that can feed into the false confession.
Yeah. You use the baseball bat to bludgeon his or her head in.
And so that potentially means that the confession sounds genuine, even though it's not. So I think that's, again, why we need to start circling back to what's actually happening in the interview room. Was there coercion? And I should say coercion, it's psychological coercion. I mean, physical coercion is outlawed now, but I mean, psychological coercion is just as harmful. So we need to be aware of whether there's been coercion that's taken place in that interview, because that's the best hint at whether the confession is likely or not. Because one thing I didn't say about the Reid technique is that technique significantly increases the risk of false confession compared to other interview techniques. So when someone's subjected to something like the Reid technique, we have to be very skeptical of any confession evidence that comes out of it.
Because I'm really nice and I cut you off earlier.
Didn't even notice.
Yeah, no, so many times. Which time? what were the other problematic... Have you mentioned all the problematic elements of the Reid technique that you were mentioning before?
I mean, I think they're the main things. Yeah. I mean, I suppose the only other thing I would say is that the Reid technique also encourages isolation. So basically, the environment in which someone is interviewed, which is probably a question you had for me. So, you know, basically the way that a police interrogation is set up is that it tries, the goal is to give the interviewee or the suspect as very little control as possible. So the interviewee shouldn't have control over the lighting, the heating, whether they receive food or drink. You know, that you're basically putting them in a situation where they feel powerless and like they have no control over what's going to happen. That's ultimately the environment that's created that allows some of these techniques to be effective as well.
Would that not like physical coercion has been outlawed, but like would not this isolation, sleep deprivation, like heating elements be skirting the rules to an extent in that?
Well, that's the thing, right, is that, you know, physical coercion was outlawed in the United States in these interrogative procedures. So, you know, we historically, you heard of things like waterboarding and physical abuse. These things can't be used, right? That's completely illegal. But psychological coercion is kind of, I would argue, it's just as serious. In fact, in some cases, it can be even more damaging because it's, you know, there can be lasting psychological effects. But sleep deprivation, you know, making the interview last for hours and hours, it's a risk factor, it's coercive. You know, using emotional manipulation, isolation, presenting fake evidence, like it's all trickery and deceit, but it's allowed under the Reid technique.
Can they withhold like food and water? Like,
I'm not so sure if that side of things has been amended in a United States context, or whether that
stretch the time at which they gave them food or water, I suppose yeah, if it's not monitored or anything like that, it's not like someone's coming in saying, oh, they're legislatively like entitled to some food and water at this stage of the interrogation or anything like that.
Well, I think one thing that they're starting to be a push towards now is making sure that the length of interviews is as short as possible, because yeah, that is, it's a risk factor that I didn't mention before, but it kind of ties into sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
The length of the interview is often a predictor of false confession. If someone's being subject to hours and hours and hours of interrogation, they're going to crack eventually. And so that's, you know, that plays into the Reid technique of like keeping people there, feeling like they have no power, you know, that's going to lead to a false confession. So yeah, I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. No, I'm...
But I suppose I don't know too much about the, you know, every, like in Australia, the United States have different, many more jurisdictions than here, but the Reid technique generally is still used in the States. Even though some police forces might use different practices, it's, Australia stopped using the Reid technique many years ago, but it's still being very much used in an American context.
Have you really
just digest that
really maybe. On hang on a minute. Just to let my brain reset. Did you watch the TV show Mindhunter?
I haven't yet.
You haven't?
It's on my list.
I only watched half of the first season, so I'm not really prepared to have this conversation either. What I know about it is that it was a dude called Holden Ford and some other bloke, and they went and started investigating serial killers to try and understand like deeper psychopathologies of murder and serial killing and whatnot.
Yeah.
I think that was roughly around the time the behavioral analysis unit was like involved in that, and they developed like, it sounds roughly the right time they developed the Reid technique as well.
Yes.
Sounds like they were going off at that point in time. Really evidence-based practice. And
well, that's the thing, and there's literally, I can't think of a single piece of evidence that supports the Reid technique.
I suppose it's like, legislatively, like there's so many things that lag. For example, like, you know, I think it was only until the 90s that husbands couldn't rape their wives legislatively. They couldn't be charged for it or something like that. But it's shocking to me that 50 years later, viscerally from what you've explained about the Reid technique, is still utilized and endorsed in the world. But I suppose that's leads into a way bigger conversation.
But I suppose on that note, if we can kind of try to flip this in some positive light, Australia did have a history of using the Reid technique years ago. There were wrongful conviction cases here that arose through false confession. And as a result of things that were happening here in other countries, the Reid technique was outlawed here. So here, we're lucky we don't have the Reid technique being used anymore. And I think that to me suggests that Australia is a step ahead. Australia's system is responding to some of the problems that we're seeing with wrongful convictions and trying to address them proactively.
Yeah, that is a positive light.
It doesn't mean that there's still not risk factors. You can still have voluntary false confessions. You can still have, you know, it's possible that even if, you know, even if techniques are outlawed, it doesn't mean that there might not be little elements of coercion that might come into things. Like, it's, anything is possible, right? I'm not, you know, I think genuinely police officers and interviewers are always trying to do the right thing. I think there's, for the most part, very good intentions. But when you've got a system like in America where this type of coercion is encouraged and it's part of formal training, that's a huge concern. Like, it's good that Australia has moved well beyond that.
In Australia, I think... Oh, gosh, I'm going to get this wrong, but it's okay. It's my podcast.
you can edit out.
I can do it. I can get rid of it. I think the maximum amount of time that we're allowed to hold people is roughly 48 hours, 24 to 48
Sounds
hours, something
familiar.
Like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Audience, take that with a grain of salt, please.
I was going to say, I find with Australia, because you have the different jurisdictions across different states, and then you've got, you know, the uniform procedure rules, and you have the kind of overarching rules, I always find the distinctions a little confusing.
Yeah.
So I always revert back to my psychology background then and say, well, I'm in psychology, not the law.
Yeah. I mean, I have a degree in criminology now, so I should know something, but I'm just, you know, anyway, Let's assume it's 24 to 48 hours for the sake of conversation. Is there... I'm asking you another law-based question, I think, but I'm not sure. But,
we'll see how
yeah, the interviews that occur within those times of holdings, are they what is being limited, or is it the maximum amount of time, do you think, that, like, they're shortening that?
I mean, so...
I suppose they can't interview someone for 48 hours, full
yeah,
stop.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be amazed when you hear of American cases of people being interviewed for days, like, without breaks. You think... If you think about being in that situation, like, I get frustrated when I'm being held up for an hour or two, or, like, you know, I'm stuck in traffic for an hour.
Or getting,
like,
podcasted for longer than 40 minutes.
You know,
like,
yeah,
you know,
that kind of thing, right? Like, you get agitated, you just want to get out of the situation.
Mm.
If you can imagine, like, imagine that you're in a very high high-pressure, stressful situation, like you're being interrogated by police, where you're being accused of something you didn't do, and not only have you got that high-stress situation, but it's lasting for what feels like, I mean, what literally is hours and hours, and for,
if not days,
for days. What would you do to get out of it? Right, if every time you say I didn't do this, you're being cut off, you're not being believed, nothing you say is registering, what would you do? Like, I think to myself, when I think of it like that, I would confess.
I can't even imagine that for an hour.
Yeah,
you know, if someone was being that,
I mean, I'd probably confess after 5 minutes of being grilled about something. But, you know, so I think that's what I always tell people when they say, this doesn't happen. I say, okay, well, imagine you're in this situation. You're being accused of something you didn't do. It's very serious. You're trying to put forward your innocence. You're getting being shut down. There's false evidence being presented to you. People are playing with your emotions. You have no control over the situation. And you just want to get out. Like, that's a very normal human reaction.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And we all feel that. And so that's what I always say. And usually people say, okay, yeah, I think I probably would confess.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to start educating people about, is that this is more common than we think when you consider all these factors that lead to someone saying, yes, okay, I did it.
Well, you mentioned, like, limiting the time of interviews as a method of potentially reducing wrongful conviction. Is there any other red flags, things to target?
So one thing that, I mean, all, I know Australia has legislation, well, some Australian states, I can't speak for all of them, but I know that confessions have to be given voluntarily, and so there needs to be a way to check that it's voluntary. So there's a mandatory recording of suspect interviews. That, you know, that's quite important, because I think it has a few different implications. If an interview is being recorded, there's less of a chance of coercion coming into it, because, you know, when we're being observed, we behave very well for the most part. It also improves accountability, well, it creates an accountability for police or interviewers so that they know that anything that they do in that context can be viewed or listened. I should say, when I say recording, typically it's audio recording is the bare minimum that needs to be done. So there needs to be an audio recording.
Right.
In the interview.
Okay.
So that's a really important safeguard. And it's also important because if we suspect that there is coercion or that the confession isn't voluntary, there's a way of checking. Because you can listen to it. Or you can watch. And I should say, I think the best thing to do is to have video recording of interrogations because coercion is not always verbal.
No.
And so there can be things happening in the room. You know, there's some American cases that I was listening to where the interview would suddenly stop, so the recording would pause, and the person was adamant, like, they didn't do it. And then the recording would start again, and all of a sudden the person's confessing. So that's not good enough either. You need a whole recording of the interview from start to finish so that you know how that interview's unfolded. How did you get to the confession?
I suppose there's room, I don't know why my mind went here, but it did. I suppose there's room for sort of like an oversight, like external oversight, like of the police in like for interviewing of suspects and whatnot. Just in terms of like if it's not enough. I suppose it sort of lends itself to the same problem, though, I suppose, to an extent.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, and like I said, I'll say it again, because I think, you know, Australia's done a pretty good job in this respect, and nothing I've said today is my way of saying, you know, that people are trying to do the wrong thing.
No.
It's, unfortunately, there's been a system built up where confessions are always the sought-after information for police or investigators, and so, like you said, that confirmation bias comes in of like, okay, this person's a suspect. They're a suspect for a reason. They must be guilty. So how can we elicit that confession from them?
I suppose that's such like a fine balance to strike as well. It's just like, well, if we're not attempting to get a confession, what are we attempting to get? If we don't somewhat apply an appropriate amount of pressure, then it's unlikely that someone who is guilty is going to adjusts from their story that suggests their innocence.
Yeah. And I suppose that one thing I definitely do want to emphasize is that Australia, so remember before I said that America has a history and they still use this very interrogative approach,
yeah,
that framework of interrogation. Australia's framework now is very different.
Really?
It's not an interrogation, it's an investigative interview. That's what it's called.
Right.
So the language is kind of changed around what the interview looks like, but it's also not guilt presumptive. It's about information gathering.
Right.
So the goal is not to get a confession or to assume someone's guilty to get that confession. It's about what can we do in this interview to find out more. As you know, so it doesn't make the assumption that the person in front of you is guilty of something. And so the actual techniques that are used, you know, the Reid techniques used in America now, but Australia uses the peace model, which is a highly effective model that decreases the risk of false confession.
That's fantastic.
Which is good.
I like the idea of the peace model. That's like really nice as
yes.
well. It's just like they're really trying to address the culture around it by, I suppose, like how you get it to go down the generations, I suppose, and into new teachings or whatnot. So.
And I mean, so the peace model, it's named that way because it's got different stages of the model and it's an acronym.
Yeah.
So there's the different stages. It's just nice. I think there was probably a bit of
maneuvering
it so it had a nice name like peace. But the thing I really like about the peace technique is that it's always been evidence-based because it was developed in consultation with academics and practitioners. So it was developed in like the early 2000s by police forces in the UK, so England and Wales, and researchers and academics over there. So they came together to find a solution to the problem.
Right.
And I think that's nice because I think with any kind of, you know, any psychological phenomena like this, like a false confession or, you know, any psychological dynamic like interviewing, you need an evidence base, but that evidence base should come from people working in the field and people who have the research knowledge or expertise to bring it together.
The combination of evidence-based and practice-based evidence-based practice and practice-based evidence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I think
gotta
that also helps
results.
Stop the like you said, there's often that latency or that delay between when we know something works and when it gets implemented. But when you can work together, you can see that not only do you have the best solutions or the best practices, but they can be implemented in a much shorter time frame. So, yeah. So we use the PEACE model here, according to all of I should say there's not a whole heap of publicly available information on what police actually do day to day, but there are, you know, newsletters and there are secondary resources from police forces that suggest that they're adopting the PEACE model. So that's positive.
This is kind of question that I sort of had myself. It's a little slightly off track, but I suppose I'm interested in it. What are the roles of psychologists? Yes, my favorite.
I haven't heard of those.
What are the roles of psychologists as expert witnesses in cases that potentially involve false confessions? Can they protect against people who have given coerced confessions, or could they alternatively solidify a coerced confession in sort of like a worst case scenario?
Yeah, that is a good question, because I suppose the role of psychologists, I mean, I suppose there's, when you think of psychologists in the legal system in terms of experts, there's two things you can think of. You can think of, you know, clinical psychologists or psychologists who work in forensic or clinical practice that might, you know, they might make decisions on someone's level of risk or, and I'm not talking about suspects here, but I'm saying, you know, whether someone was criminally responsible, they can speak to those kind of questions. But you can also have academic psychologists or psychology researchers. So I think that seems to be more the latter that you're getting at. Like, yeah. What role can people with expertise in false confessions play? Yeah. I don't know of any specific examples of that in an Australian context. I know that there are academics overseas that do testify to these things in court. It's tricky, because I suppose when you get to the point of going to trial, I mean, the confession's already been given, and the defense team often will say that the confession wasn't voluntary or that it was false and the person's retracted the confession. There is some research that suggests even when jurors have reason to believe that the confession wasn't voluntary or came about through coercion, they still use the confession as an indicator of guilt. So I don't know that psychologists testifying would always improve the situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a whole heap of research on expert testimony where experts don't always have the intended effects. So sometimes you get, instead of experts helping people to discriminate between, you know, what good and bad evidence is, sometimes it just causes skepticism overall. So I suppose that's a long way of saying I don't know of any data or projects that have looked at that specific question, but I'd say that I think awareness is just the main thing. If we can start having more conversations like this one, we can start seeing more, you know, we start listening to wrongful conviction cases where this has happened, we see more Netflix series like Mindhunter. I mean, that's probably... You know,
neither of us have watched it, so let's not recommend it.
As well, like the confession tapes. Like, this is a really big Netflix series, or, you know, I don't know what to call it. Yeah, a Netflix series that brings to light the issues with confession evidence, and that not all confessions are true. And so just starting to bring that awareness to the fact that confessions aren't always what meets the eye.
Have the thought on the table during the process.
Yeah, because I think we're starting to become more aware of the fact that there are false confessions.
Yeah.
And that's part of breaking this idea of everyone thinking that if you wouldn't confess to a crime if you didn't do it. Coming back to what I said earlier, that's what people generally think. But if we can start showing examples where this isn't true and people have falsely confessed, then we can start to see more scrutiny in court if there is confession evidence being given. That's, you know, so I think that education is the key. So podcasts like this certainly do help with that. So,
yeah, I'm certainly learning a lot. I suppose we've already kind of touched on, like, is there any particular gaps in our knowledge about false confessions in the Australian legal context that you think can be addressed or filled? academically or in practice?
Yeah, we don't have, there's not a lot of research that's based in Australia. A lot of the false confession work is based in countries like the United States. There's a bit more work here around investigative interviewing, like how police should interview, not necessarily always suspects of crimes, but like what are good models of interviewing. So there's a little bit more of a space for that here. I think just genuinely we need to acknowledge that our system is different to the United States, and so there should be more research that looks at, I mean, I think this is true for anything in our legal systems that differs across countries or jurisdictions, is do those findings generalize to here?
Research should be contextual.
Yeah, I mean, false confession research is very hard to do because ethics committees, understandably, would, you know, a lot of the really cool research that's been done in the United States is actually not about false confessions of crimes, but it would be, you know, participants might come into the lab and they might be told that they're going to do a computer task and they can't press a key on the computer or the computer will crash. And then the computer will crash even if the person didn't press the key, and they will be told that they have to confess to doing it. And so it's a nice proxy to understand false confessions without having to kind of go to the complete other end of the spectrum of looking at, you know, criminal false confession. But there's also some research that's been done in America that suggests that you can implant false memories of people committing crimes. And again, ethically tricky to do, but it shows that, you know, these research, there needs to be some research that can be used as a proxy to understand false confessions here.
Just for my own benefit in terms of understanding the ethical implications of this type of research, or I suppose research that is considered sketchy, not even sketchy, I don't know the implications yet, but like, what makes this type of, like, what's the ethical considerations in this type of research that are concerns? Is it like the deception, or is it the...
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose with any, you know, being an eyewitness researcher first and foremost, some of the things that ethics committees are concerned about, quite understandably, are things like distress. You know, if you're showing people graphic materials, or if you're subjecting people to coercion, that can be highly distressing. Even if you give, you know, I mean, one thing you have to do with this kind of research is you have to, after the study, give a very clear reason for why you had to show people graphic materials or subject them to things that are quite distressing. You need to give good reasons for that. So the benefits outweigh the risks of the research. That's always what ethics committees consider. But yeah, I suppose deception is a big one as well. Is deception has to be absolutely necessary. And to look at something like false confessions, it typically there needs to be an element of deception. But things like informed consent, because if you're deceiving people about what the study is truly looking at, then can people give proper informed consent?
It's always the beneficence, what we receive from our research needs to outweigh the potential distress of the participants.
Exactly. And so I think you always have to frame it. Like, when I do eyewitness research, if I have to show people a video that's maybe violent or graphic, I need to justify why that stimulus is necessary to look at whatever it is I'm looking at. And if there's any way that I can do the research without needing to show that graphic material, then it's always going to be recommended you do that. So it's always just weighing up, like, are the benefits outweighing the risks? Are people informed of what their rights are? You know, are people like thoroughly debriefed at the end of the study if there's deception? You're just making sure those things are in place. But yeah, there's, you know, understandably with something like false confessions, ethics committees would be thinking, you know, that's highly stressful to subject people to a situation where they're being pressured into confessing to something that they didn't do. So there would be an understandable risk there that would have to be managed and mitigated.
How do they determine whether the participant... we're getting into an ethical conversation on research, but I'm loving it. How do they determine the potential distress the participants would undergo with research like this?
Well, I suppose, I mean, the ethics committees, this is probably not true of every ethics committee, but at least here in Australia, a lot of the university ethics committees have people from all different disciplines on their board. So you're getting different perspectives. There's often a lawyer, a lay person who's like a representative of the community. And they'll all pick up on different things about a project. I suppose what they're looking at is there any risk of harm, distress, or inconvenience? And they kind of look at the, you know, inconvenience is in some ways much more minor.
What are they going to do?
Yeah, I mean, inconvenience could be something like giving up their time,
yeah.
You know, or having to, you know, get to a research study that's like quite far out of their way or something like that. So, you know, that's obviously like a lower level of risk or something that can be more easily managed. But then with something like, you know, false confession research, if you're subjecting people to a high pressure situation, there is the potential for lasting harm. So they're looking at what are some of the things that you can put in place. Can you refer people to services that they might need if they do feel distressed? Can you avoid the need to, not disclose things? Or can you avoid the need for deception? Is there a way you can do the study while telling people what the study is actually about so they're fully informed? So it's
finding the possible alternatives, if they are there to get the knowledge that you or information that you want.
Yeah, and ethics committees are great because they give you such...
That is the first time I've heard someone say that.
Well, I mean, I'm very happy to say it because I appreciate what they do in that they hold us accountable to make sure that our research is as safe as possible. But they also help... I mean, sometimes when you're involved in a project, you're so focused on it that you don't necessarily... You're not always thinking about the potential risk of something that you might consider to be quite minor, or, you know, you're getting all these other perspectives.
It
and
becomes,
so,
like, desensitized to the potential that it, like, could...
Yeah, I think it's more just that you sometimes get lost in your own project, that you don't always see the things that other people see. And
yeah.
So that additional oversight of, hey, actually, this could be interpreted badly, or this could be interpreted like this, why don't you change this? And that feedback, I think, always makes the project better.
Yeah.
And it makes the project safer, and it means that we can be most sure that our projects are as ethical as possible. And that's really important.
Hmm. Well, my last question was, what can audience members do who are interested in false and coerced confessions do to get involved? I suppose research is like probably one of the primary things. Is there anything else?
Well, I mean, I suppose there's a few things. There's research groups around the country that work in forensic psychology. So contact researchers if you're interested in volunteering or having conversations about these things, you know, going to lab meetings, learning about these types of topics. Another thing you can do is, you know, look for kind of local, I won't call them innocence projects, but projects that work on wrongful convictions. So often these projects take on volunteers, and there might be cases where there might be confession evidence that you can help to unpack. And the final thing I would say is just be educated, like read some articles or watch some of the things that are on Netflix that talk about confessions and false confessions, because like I said, I think the education is the important part so that we start seeing far fewer false confessions occurring and far fewer wrongful convictions. So just education, spreading the word and telling people about it is important.
I'm really glad we got to talk and wrap this up really nicely, but I have to jump back halfway through what because I'm curious about one thing and I forgot to ask you.
Okay,
about
that's
it.
Fine. I'll try and end it on a positive note.
Yeah, I was like, we're wrapping it up so nicely. How do I stop this? That's not my style.
Okay.
We're
gonna spiral again.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just like, let's hang on. We'll go back. We'll try it again. Hang on, I gotta restart the podcast. You mentioned people retract confessions.
Yep.
Why would they do that? Like, I obviously, like, people who, like, provide false confessions would, like, obviously, I can understand why they would retract confessions, like, once sort of the stress had subsided and they realized what they had done and
yeah.
everything. But, like, let's say someone who did commit a crime, gave a confession and then decided to retract it. Why?
I mean, I don't know too much about... I mean, like you said, I think the reasons why people who have falsely confessed would retract it are quite obvious. When you escape, you're finally out of that situation, you can think clearly and rationally and realise what the consequences are. It makes sense that... And, in fact, a lot of people who falsely confess end up saying, no, that was, you know, that was because of coercion, or I didn't actually do it. Potentially, I'm speculating here, but I suppose people who have actually committed a crime that are confessing might regret confessing. And so they might confess and then think, oh, actually, I don't really want to be convicted of this, and retract it.
Is there any... ask you another legal question. Is there any... Do you think there's any... What's the difference to a jury member if a person provided confession and then retracted? Because I assume that's still admissible in court, or that discussion can come up. Maybe it can't. Further speculation incoming.
Yeah, I don't, I don't want to speculate. Yeah. So I suppose... But just going back to, you know, I know in America that even... And I'm speaking about an American context, but even people who do falsely confess that then end up saying, like before the trial, that no, that confession was, you know, due to coercion, it wasn't voluntary, I take it back.
Yeah, it's inadmissible.
Then even if that confession comes to light in the trial, that can still impact upon the jury's decision. So
yeah.
I think I always like to say confessions have a very corruptive quality, because once somebody confesses, the police will stop investigating because they, you know, they have the person. Well, they presume they have the person, so there's no point further investigating. So there's no other leads after that point, or there's no other investigation. Some experts who give testimony might be biased if they know whether the person confessed, so it can corrupt their evidence. It can corrupt the juror's decisions, and so I feel like it has a snowball effect.
Yeah.
And so
I like the idea of corruptive. Like,
yeah.
It's like a really nice word for that.
I think it's
yeah.
just, they have a corruptive quality to them. So I think, you know, when it, trying to bring this back to another positive thing, if we think about, well, what can we do to prevent that? I think part of it is trying to prevent the false confession from happening in the first place.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, like I said, with voluntary false confessions, there's often very little you can do because that they're not arising through police practice. They just happen. But any that involve coercion, you know, presenting false evidence is, you know, that needs to be absolutely cut out. All these kinds of things. So try to prevent them from the get-go. But if we can't prevent them, then at least doing what we can in the trial and in the remainder of the process to make sure that they don't have this corruptive quality.
Yeah.
I suppose. So I don't know if that was a positive note. But,
no, no,
know,
no, no, it was
I'll
perfect. No, no, no,
a,
it's so exciting.
You know,
nope,
but,
so exciting's not the right word.
But our knowledge is continually advancing. You know, we'll find out a lot more. We'll hopefully see less of these cases occurring. In Australia, I think that since changes have been made and the peace model's being used, I think this is not the same problem we have previously seen. But I think we can still all do more.
Yeah.
And I think as a society, we can do more. So we should all be involved.
Yeah, definitely.
Is that positive?
Yeah, that was great. No, that was perfect. Yeah, no, I'll give you a zapper later for it.
Thank you.
No worries. It's been so great having you on today, Hayley.
Thanks, Nick.
It was
really,
great chat.
Really enjoyed it. Thank
yeah,
you.
Cool. All right, I hope we can talk again.
Me too.
You've been listening to the UON Crim Podcast, hosted by Nick Minch, run by the University of Newcastle's Criminology and Criminal Justice Society. I would like to thank today's guest, Hayley Cullen, and the podcast team, Jess Horn and Zalia Windham. Please stay tuned for our next episode. You can stay up to date by following the UON CCJS on social media. Thanks for listening.